So this is the first of four classes that we're enfolding into the retreat here on the Sanskrit text called the Ashtavaka Gita. This will constitute one of the what we're calling middle way center courses. The Wisdom's Heart group in Cape Ann is a middle way center. I once saw someone from a middle way center in Los Angeles. Where's Peter? Oh, there he is. Are you the only one from LA? Hey, good on you. And there's a middle way center in Nashville, Tennessee. Is Nashville in the house? Anyone else from the Middle Way Center that I didn't mention? So anyway, these are courses based on four class courses based on classics from the Pali and Sanskrit canon from India, and each one of these classes has an exercise that comes with it. So in case you didn't have anything else to do on retreat here, you might consider doing the exercise that is attached to each of these classes. The ideal way to do that would be over 4 weeks. So you do the exercise for a week. So, you know, maybe there's other things that you want to be doing on this retreat, but then you could go home and review the classes and then do a week's worth of exercise per class. And then you really maybe get something out of the course. The Ashtavaka Gita is one of the great classics of what they call the Advaita Vedanta tradition. Advaita means non-dualistic, Advaita. And Vedanta means sort of the essence of the Veda, the essence of the sacred texts of ancient India. And I first discovered this text, not in my academic career, where I should have known about it, but I didn't. But I was teaching in Singapore and wanted to do a class on the Bhagavad Gita to a Hindu group. And at the time I was a Buddhist monk, and so they were a little concerned. And so they interviewed me before I could give a teaching in their you know, kind of association there. And you know, I passed, and then I gave the teaching. It was all good. And at the end, I think, of that, somebody said, You should know about this Sanskrit text called the Ashtavaka Gita. And I said, what? I don't know. I never heard of it. And so they went into the back room and they pulled out this, like, you know, kind of water-soaked, you know, dirty old copy of, which is often the case in such places. You know, I took it home and looked at it and was amazed. I mean, it's one of the most amazing texts in world spiritual literature. I'll just put it that way. I mean, you know, it's a teacher's text. It's a, you know, like some of the greatest of the modern Indian teachers have taught this text. People like Rajneesh Osho was really into this text. People like Sri Sri Ravi Shankar spent a lot of time teaching this text. Swami Chinmayananda also. So it's not widely known except for the cognoscenti. The cognoscenti know it. Those who are in the know it. And so now you guys are in the know too. And we can't do all of the text. It's very long. It's 18 chapters. But we'll do a kind of a survey. I think the first two classes are more or less the complete chapters 1 and 2. And then we'll kind of skip a bunch. And then we'll do a bunch of verses from the 18th chapter, which is probably the climax of the text. So this was a text that was probably written in the 9th century AD, probably by a student of a teacher named Shankara. Shankara was the great founder of the Advaita Vedanta tradition in India. And it purports to be a conversation between a teacher and a student, as many of the texts from India do. The The teacher is named Ashta Avraka. Say Ashta Avraka. Ashtavraka. This is not that hard. So Ashta means eight. Avraka means crooked limbs. So he was the guy with eight crooked limbs. And I believe that there is an asana. And so maybe the yoga teachers will introduce the asana at some point in the teaching, just as a kind of honorific. It's a pretty hard one, isn't it? So anyway, they can demonstrate it. What the Ashtavraka asana, right? Ashtavraka asana. So the story is that Ashtavraka was a very precocious embryo. In his mother's womb, he listened to his father outside the womb, of course. Not room in there for too many people. He overheard his father reciting the sacred texts, the Vedas in Sanskrit, reciting them. And he heard that mistakes. And so he shouted out from the womb, Dad, you missed that like vowel there, you know, whatever. And his dad got pretty pissed off and cursed him to have eight crooked limbs. So don't worry, there's a happy ending. So his dad was kind of like, you know, a little arrogant. And he was in a debate with another Brahmin and lost the debate. And I think he was thrown to the bottom of the sea or something like that. And when Ashtavraka heard about it, he went in and rescued his father. And his father then lifted the curse, so he didn't have eight crooked limbs anymore. But he was still called Ashtavraka. Gita means song, by the way. And this is the other major song in traditional Sanskrit India, Sanskritic India. The other one is the Bhagavad Gita, a much more famous text, actually. And it's interesting that they're both songs. You know, because song is kind of funky speech, isn't it? It's playful speech. It's like poetry. You know, it's not ordinary speech. And so I was thinking about that today, after the play talk, that this is a Gita, this is a song, after all. The other protagonist is named Janaka. Janaka is a well-known figure in Sanskrit literature. He appears all over the place. Like, even very early in the Upanishads, the ancient Upanishads, which are, you know, dated to at least 500 BC and earlier probably. Janaka's like popping up all over the place. He's a stock figure. And he's a king, which is not insignificant. He's a kind of a king sage. He's a smart king. He's a king who wants to know what's what. He's a king who's in search of wisdom. And again, the comparison to the other Gita, to the Bhagavad Gita, is maybe useful, because the other protagonist, the one protagonist of the Bhagavad Gita, is Krishna, who we just sang to. And the other one is Arjuna, who is also a kind of a prince king. He's a warrior, but he's royalty. He's in the Kshatriya Varna, the Kshatriya class. So there are lots of interesting similarities between the two Gitas. They're both conversations between a teacher and a king. But the king is also the student, you know. So among other things, both texts are about the teacher-student relationship. But they diverge in some ways about the teacher-student relationship, in ways that I'll talk about in a minute when we get to the text itself. The Ashtavraka Gita is about a concept called Jiva, say Jiva, Mukta. Mukta means a liberated one. And Jiva means in this very lifetime. Jivan, sometimes it's Jivan Mukta. So there's a whole yoga school called Jiva Mukta, Jiva Mukti in New York and now around the world. And that's exactly what that means, liberated in this very lifetime. And it was a controversial idea in India. It's still a controversial idea, you know, worldwide. Is it possible to reach the final goal of a spiritual path while still embodied in this very, you know, in this body, in this lifetime? Is it possible? There was arguments about this in ancient India. So it's a controversial idea. there was a whole kind of school of opposition saying, no, how would it be possible to get to the enlightened stage, to be liberated, while carrying around something like this? Because this is an accident waiting to happen. Right? This is guaranteed to bring you pain. Guaranteed, right? So it's kind of a lot easier to think about liberation when you go flap, 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 flap away, and shed this mortal coil. Isn't that the poetic... Yes, thank you. Is it possible to be enlightened in this very lifetime? The same controversy occurred in the Buddhist texts. There's two different understandings of nirvana. Nirvana with nothing remaining. Nirvana with nothing left over, which means nirvana outside the body. Nirvana after death of the body, you could say. Parinirvana, as they sometimes call it. Ultimate nirvana. But then there, actually in the Buddhist story, he was enlightened in this lifetime. The story of the Buddha, Gautama, the so-called historical Buddha, was enlightened at the age of about 30 or something, 20, something like 30, I think. And then taught for, 60 years or something, 50, 60 years before he took parinirvana, also known as he died, his body died. So there's nirvana with nothing left over, but then there's nirvana with something left over, and the something left over is this. So you can see that it could be a controversial subject. Is it possible? Is it possible for us to reach the final goal without dying, before death? You see, before death. And this text argues, strenuously, that yes, it's totally possible. And the secret is, I'll give it away, all right? The secret is to totally de-identify with your body. You are not your body. And it says that over and over and over again in the text. See, if you're identified with your body, it's pretty hard to see how you're going to be enlightened in the body, you see, if you're identified with it. Because it's, like I said, accident waiting to happen, plenty of problems. Anyone not have problems with their body? There's always something wrong with the body, right? When there's not something big wrong, there's something little wrong. And the body's limited, obviously limited. The body also keeps... Identification with the body keeps us separate from each other. Right? If we think that we are our bodies, then we are limited to the end of our bodies. And that's not liberation. Liberation is not feeling separate, isolated, and alienated from other beings. So, of course, if you're identified with your body, you will never feel anything other than separate and alienated and isolated from other beings, which is not enlightenment, is not nirvana, is not freedom, is not liberation. So the other element, the other theme that this text sort of implicitly explores, it explicitly explores the idea of jivan mukti, liberation in this lifetime. But implicitly, it also explores a very common sort of controversy in world spiritual literature. Is liberation sudden or gradual? Sudden or gradual? And, many, many disputes about this. Many, schismatic, divisions of opinion on this. And they should have asked me, It's both, of course. Gradually, you get to the point where you're suddenly enlightened. How could it be otherwise than that, It's a gradual process, as we all know. It can't be sudden in the sense of never having to work for it or learn anything or develop yourself or anything like that. But then it can't be anything other than sudden either. It's not you're the bionic man that gets a little enlightened down here and then it kind of gradually moves up the ankle and then your whole right leg is enlightened. That's gradual enlightenment, isn't it? Right? And then the other leg gets enlightened, and then the torso finally gets enlightened. Not like that. It has to happen in a finger snap, in a blink of an eye. And we see in the text that's exactly what happens to Janaka. In the second chapter, which don't look ahead, okay? happens just like that. After he hears a single teaching from his teacher. So, is that all we need to hear is a single teaching? Well, depends how ripe you are. Could be. You know, there are plenty of stories like, you know, there's a story, for example, of the Buddha coming into a group of students and just raising a flower. And then a bunch of people saw the flower and went, boom, 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 popped into enlightenment. You know, because they were ready. Didn't need to say anything. Just be the occasion for their ripening. You know? So that's another kind of theme. So we got the Jivan Mukti theme, we got the teacher-student relationship thing, we've got the sudden versus gradual enlightenment thing, and those are the ones that the text explores. So we can start ahead. I've called this course "Liberation in This Very Lifetime," Jivan Mukti, "How to Live Freely and Happily." So I thought it would be a very, very good course to offer as part of the theme of this retreat. You know, play. So class one, if you have your reading there, entitled "The False and True Selves." And this class covers the entirety of the first chapter. And the text begins, Janaka Uvachas. Janaka says, Master, tell me, how can I obtain wisdom, freedom, and detachment? He pops a question. And this text, like many, many other texts, begins with a question, really. The Heart Sutra begins with a question. The Dhammakaya Sutra begins with a question. Bhagavad Gita really begins with a question. After a long whine, first chapter of Arjuna just whining, he finally gets to the point where he says, can you help me here, Krishna? That's kind of what he's says. And so Janaka asks a question. He asks a question of his teacher, Stavraka. I was just teaching a course in Nashville on the Diamond Cutter Sutra. After Subhuti asked the question of the Buddha, who is not called the Buddha in that whole text. It's called Lord, but not the Buddha. Because the whole text is about who the real Buddha is, not some guy. Anyway, So he asks, Subhuti asks the question, he asks his question, and then the first thing that the Buddha says is, sadhu, sadhu. That's awesome. You know, it's not until the end of the Heart Sutra that the Buddha says, sadhu, sadhu, after these guys, do a whole big dialogue about, emptiness and truth and all like that. In other words, the Buddha was congratulating him for the question. What a good question. So what's your question? You know, ask a good question. Ask a good question of yourself. The questions are probably more important than the answers in a lot of ways. You know? So what do you want to know? Like whether the Red Sox will win the pennant this year? Well, that's just one possible question that you might have. No, we have all kinds of irrelevant questions, not so good questions. What would be a good question to ask? So anyway, Janaka, King Janaka, thought that this would be a good question to ask. Tell me how I can wise up, how I can get jnana. Jnana means wisdom. Wisdom means transformative knowledge, not just data, okay, not just facts and figures. But something that goes deep and works on the hard disk and changes you into a different kind of a being. How can I get that? Mukti. How can I be free? How can I be free of all the things that chain me? You know, the things that we were talking about this afternoon. Especially karma and klesha. Especially karma. You know, the compulsion to always have to do something. And klesha, the mental afflictions that harass our minds all the time. Okay? You know, they count the kleshas, the mental afflictions, as 84,000. There are 84,000 different kinds, which, it just means a gajillion. That's about as high as they could count or something like that. And so, and So we are having them all the time. Any time that you're dissatisfied, you are having a klesha. Any time that you're anything other than perfectly content and happy, you're being harassed by a mental affliction. And so the end of that, freedom from that, means perfect happiness. And that doesn't mean that everything's going to go your way all the time. That's not what's meant by it. Okay? That would be an unreasonable goal. To think that everything, just only pleasant things is going to happen to you. You only meet nice people who say nice things to you all the time. You know. Like that's, we're holding out hope for this, aren't we? You know. And forget about it. You can't change the external world. You can change your responses to the external world. And when you change your responses to the external world will seem to change. Okay? But forget about micromanaging other people. How's that worked out, by the way? You know, trying to change other people and turning them into all nice people to you. You know, let alone events. Like, why would you even want to do that? Like I was saying this afternoon, why would you even want to achieve a goal of micromanaging events so that nothing was unpredictable? So there was no surprises in life. So there's no wonder, you know? There was no awe. It was all just, yeah, I knew that was going to happen. Oh, yeah, I knew that was going to happen too. Oh, yeah, I knew that. Yeah. No, people hear these goals, you know, for example, the goal of omniscience, you know, sometimes that's talked about as a goal in the Eastern tradition, sarvajna, of knowing everything. And then think, well, if you literally knew everything, that would be the same, that would be the same boring situation that I was just talking about. Nothing to learn, nothing to, in Buddhism they even have a stage for this, the stage of called no more learning, which is supposed to be the goal. Who wants that stage? You know, I don't want to be in a stage of no more learning. That would be brain dead. You know, enlightenment has to be more than brain deadism or ology. So what's the question? You know, what do you want to know, and why do you want to know it? You see, have a good question. Be led in your spiritual life by good questions, not by holding on to answers. You see. Holding on to answers precludes questions. Holding on to blind faith precludes doubt, which involves questioning. So have good questions, and then, you know, then the Buddhas are going sadhu, sadhu. They're thinking, you know. They're not just sitting around like, you know, brain dead. They're thinking. How can I obtain wisdom? How can I obtain freedom? And vairagya. Vairagya I've translated here as detachment. I changed the translation in the Yoga Sutra, which I taught recently in Austin, to imperturbability, which is a big, long, fancy English word, but it kind of gets more to it, I think. Imperturbability means unshakable, you know? Not perturbable. Nothing can rock you. You know? You're just chillaxed all the time. How can I have that chillaxed attitude? I think it's like gets at much more of what he's asking here. How can I know what's what? How can I be free? And how can I just be happy in life no matter what wave crashes into my shore? You see, imperturbable. And he only asks one question. This is the one and only question that he asks in this text. There's a first line in the text is the question, and it's the last question. Contrast that, for those of you who know, to the Bhagavad Gita, where Arjuna is questioning the whole text. It's like, well, I don't get that, Krishna. Tell me that again. I mean, what do you mean by that? You know, just like pestering the guru over and over again. And, you know, Krishna's very patient with him and says, all right, I'll try it again. 18 chapters. 18 chapters of questions. And here you got one. Very interesting. You know, he has only one. And then he listens. You know, that's kind of Arjuna's problem. He's too much like us. You know, he doesn't really listen. And he's got his own agenda, and he's kind of slow, really. A little slow-witted. And not the sharpest tool in the shed. You know, very much like all of us. And so he has to keep asking questions all the time. You know, Janaka, one question. That's his one question. So then he gets, I think, about 19 verses of answer. And that'll be tonight's class. So here we go. Ashtavaka Uvachad. If my son, you want mukti, you want freedom, you must shun the objects of sense like they were poison. There's a pun in Sanskrit. The objects of the sex is vishayan, and visha is poison in Sanskrit. Vishabhat means like poison. So shun the objects of sex, of sense, vishayan, as if they were poison, vishavat. So that's what he says to give up. To give up. So another, by the way, since we were talking about omniscience before, sarvajna, you know, it's unreasonable and undesirable to think that the goal is to know every answer to every question. To know, like, what the names of all the microbes under the ocean are. To know all the data, you know, like a supercomputer. All you need to know to have sarvajna is what to give up and what to take up. What's beneficial and what's not. That's all. That's enough. That's sarva enough. That sarva means everything. That's all you need to know. So here's what he says about what to give up and what to take up. Give up the objects of the senses like they were poison. And then take up what? Take up tolerance. Kshana. Kshana means also patience. It's the same word that's used in the Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, chapter 6. So patience. You can also translate it, I think, as forgiveness. Tolerance. Sincerity. Spelled wrong. Didn't I spell it wrong, Duncan? Thousands of dollars of education just wasted. Can't even spell sincerity. What's up with that? It was a slip. Okay. I'm practicing forgiveness on me. Yeah, thank you. Tolerance. Compassion, contentment, and truth, as if they were nectar. So, you know, think about one thing as if it were a snake. Think about these other things as if they were nectar. So, what does it mean to shun the objects of the senses? Is there something wrong with the objects of the senses? Is there something wrong with, you know, with tasting a cold glass of water? No. It's not a matter of going into some kind of shell and not, like, engaging with the objects of the senses. Shun the objects of the senses means shunning a wrong understanding of the objects of the senses. That's what it really means. So mukti, freedom, means also wisdom. You can't have mukti without wisdom. And understanding that the objects that we see, that we hear, that we smell, that we feel, that we taste, or objects that we think, because the mind is a sense object according to, you know, South Asian, whatever it is, anatomy, I don't know, whatever. It's understanding how they work. It's not shunning the objects of the senses themselves, but shunning our ignorance about them. So what is our ignorance about them? And you can think about this at several different levels. One is thinking that the pleasant things or unpleasant things that we see in the objects of the senses are in the objects of the senses. The unpleasantness or pleasantness of the objects of the senses are not in the objects of the senses. They're in our perception of the objects of the senses, right? But we don't get that, and so we think things are good or are bad, are pleasant, or are unpleasant, and so forth. And that includes people, by the way. That includes people. They are irritating. Or they are, you know, pleasant. They are friendly, see. They're not one thing or the other, you know, before you perceive them that way. So that's a sort of a deeper level of it. And we'll talk about this at various junctures, because this is wisdom. Wisdom is understanding how things really are. And things do not exist independently, they only exist interdependently. Everyone remember this from Cape Ann teachings? Yeah. Are you Cape Anners? Yeah. So, there is no visible object. Okay, that's an object of the sense, right? Object of the senses, of sense of seeing, is a visible object. There's no independently existing visible object out there. The object, for it to be visible, it must be seen. Okay? So the visible object depends on the seer that sees the visible object for it to be visible. And that's not how we see visible objects. So shun your ignorance about visible objects. That's what he said. How do we usually see visible objects? As if they were out there on their own, objectively visible. So I just, you know, try a little thought experiment. If we all left the room, would the visible objects still be there? If we all left the room, would there be a... Okay, I'll give it away, all right? A visible object. In what sense could there be a visible object that wasn't being seen? See? Doesn't make any sense. But we believe in all kinds of nonsensical things. Yeah. We believe in all... Like Alice in Wonderland, or the Queen, or whoever it was, the Queen, who said, I believe in 6 or 7 impossible things before breakfast every day. Oh, Alice, yeah. So, there's no visible object until unless there's a seer. Now, there's also no seer until and unless there's a visible object. So you can't be a seer unless you're seeing something, right? Okay? So, which comes first? The visible object or the seer? Neither one can come first. They both depend on each other. That's interdependence. Neither one can exist independently, but nor can they exist dependently. Okay? Because dependence requires there to be something that something else depends on. Requires there to be something there first that something else depends on. So a visible object depends on a seer, and a seer depends on a visible object, but neither can exist first. And that's how things do exist. And things are empty of existing in any other way than that. And that's kind of all you need to know. That's sarvajna. That's enough. That's enough omniscience. That's how things exist. And things do not exist in any other way than that, and that's shunyata in the Buddhist tradition, emptiness. And that's all. Simple as that. Now try it. See, now try to realize that. So, you know, never mind visible objects. There is no irritating person out there until and unless you are irritated. They need you to be irritated for them to be irritating. And of course they need you, you need them to be irritating to be irritated. You can't be irritated all by yourself either. No, you need an irritating person to be irritated, and the irritatedness makes the irritating person possible. And neither can come first. Neither can come first. There's not an irritating person, then you get irritated. See, you have to be irritated before you can be an irritating person. Before that, they're not an irritating person. Just a person. Right? And then you're irritated, and then they're irritating, and then you got irritating because they are irritated. And neither one can come first. And that's how things exist. And things do not exist in any other way than that. So that's shunning the objects of the senses, shunning the ignorance about the objects of the senses, and thinking that they have qualities of their own independent of you, and that you have qualities of your own independent of them either. So sometimes you hear this idea that, you know, I am projecting my world, I am, you know, right? You heard this before? Heard this kind of thing? Everything's coming from me, I'm projecting my world. That's half right at best. Because the world is projecting you too. And neither one can come first. The projector doesn't exist independently of the projected, and the projected doesn't exist independently of the projector. And neither one can come first. That's interdependence. That's how things exist. And things are empty of existing in any other way than that. To say I am the projector of the world would be an independently existing projector. Who could be the projector before projecting the world, you see. The projector becomes a projector when the projection is projected. But the projection makes the projector possible. So then he says what to take up. And it's an interesting list. Tolerance. Patience. You know, this is the first thing he says to Janaka. It's like, you know, learn how to live a good life. If you want to be free, learn how to live a good life. First of all, understand that nothing exists independently. That we're all in it together. Right? We're all connected to one another. None of us is an island. No man or woman is an island. So secondly, think about how to treat each other, treat other people. Forgive them. Have patience towards them. Have tolerance for them. They couldn't be irritating unless you are irritated. Right? And forgiveness is a major part of this. You know, sometimes people say, well, the Eastern traditions don't talk that much about forgiveness, but they enfold it into this idea of patience and tolerance. You know? And so forgiveness is, if you want to really like go to the, you know, heart of the sort of mother lode text for forgiveness, read the New Testament. Jesus is all over this. And not judging. So forgiving and not judging is kind of like one of his major messages. Over and over, it's like interesting. He's obsessed with it. With don't judge other people. Don't judge them all the time, you know, and forgive them. Of course, he was the master of forgiveness as he's like hung up on the cross, nailed up with nails on the cross. And what's his last words? You know, Father, forgive them, they're idiots. That was a loose translation of the Greek. So tolerance, sincerity. Sincerity, arjava can mean genuineness. It means genuineness. Be genuine with other people. Be genuine with yourself, which is hard enough. Be authentic. Be authentic. Don't be deceptive. And be authentic means that you start with yourself. Know who you are. Know thyself, as Socrates says, because otherwise you can't be authentic with other people. Constantly trying to be somebody. Constantly trying to put on masks. Stick your head in those two-dimensional cutouts all the time. You know, instead of being who you are. Compassion. Because we're all connected, everyone's suffering is everyone else's. Because we are all exist only interdependently, no one's suffering can be excluded from your compassion. So this is also very, very good to think about when wartime occurs, which has been occurring now nonstop for what 13, 14 years in this country without too much peep from the American people. You know, the longest war in history, the longest war in American history. And we allow it because we don't have compassion, actually. We don't have compassion for the victims, you know, of our terrorism. We just have compassion for our terrorists, not their terrorists. It's all terror, okay? It's all just terror. So compassion means you treat everyone's life as if it were equal. No one's life is more important than anyone else's life. No one's suffering is more important than anyone else's suffering. And then contentment. Made the short list. Practice contentment. If you want to be free, practice contentment, which means really practice the absence of discontentment. Remember, contentment is not an attainment, it's a cessation. It occurs when something stops. When discontentment stops, you are left with contentment. It is your base nature. Your base nature is to be content. And then we obscure it and obstruct it and, you know, mess it all up with all our discontentment. All our continual whining about how things should be better. Things should be different. Things shouldn't be the way they are. And then truth, satya. Satya is the, you know, is matching your understanding of reality to how you talk to other people. Matching how you think things are with your words to other people. And again, it's kind of just another version of sincerity, right? It's just being genuine. It's just being honest with others. And especially with yourself. You have to be honest with yourself before you can be honest with others. And we're all pretty good at self-deceiving, right? Self-deception. We're kind of masters at it. So he's saying, know yourself. If you want to be free, know yourself and know how things exist and therefore know how to treat other people. How to exist in the world with other people. Then he says, then he goes into a long thing about who you aren't, Janaka. You are not who you think you are. So this is another aspect of wising up, is letting go of false understandings, false truth, false claims to identity, really. So he starts with the body. You are not the elements. you know, in ancient India, they thought all matter was made up of these five elements: earth, water, fire, wind, or space, including the body. So all matter. You are not material, he's saying. You are not material. You are not physical. And this is a very good teaching for us living in the age that we do, where really the sort of official truth in our society is that there is only material. This is called materialism. And it works in both ways. You know, from a sort of a scientific or philosophical point of view, it means that nothing that can't be measured exists. Nothing that can't be, you know, quantified really exists. That's materialism. And then that leads to another kind of materialism. You know, that just buying stuff all the time is the way to be happy. Because happiness must be material too. If everything's material, then happiness must be material as well. So we just keep consuming in the hopes that we can buy our way into happiness because it's all just material. So he's saying, you are not the elements, you are not material. In order to be free, you must know the true self, Atman, Atman in Sanskrit, which is regularly used in the Sanskrit text to talk about your deeper nature, your true nature, your Svabhava, your true self, your true nature. You must know the true self, the heart of consciousness, Chidrupa, the heart of consciousness, the observer of these objects. The word in Sanskrit for observer is Sakshin, Sakshin. And the dictionary is quite clear on it. It means eyewitness. It kind of literally means eyewitness. It's the word used for the subject as opposed to the object. So the Sakshin is the subject, and then the Vishaya or whatever it is the object. So this is a bit of a puzzle, because I don't think he's saying here that you are, that your true self is the subject in exactly the way that we think of it. It's not the I, for sure. It's not the I. And it's not the subject that exists only interdependently with an object. There is no subject until and unless there's an object that the subject perceives. And there's no object until and unless the subject is perceiving it. Okay? That's interdependence also. So there's no subject, there's no me that exists independently either. There's no subject that's sitting around going, soon I will perceive something. The subject comes into existence when the subject perceives an object. That's interdependence, right? And there's no object until and unless the subject perceives it. So the Sakshin here can't mean the witness in that sense. It can't mean that. Because that's part of the interdependence, the kind of like, you know, deceptive reality that we live in. The reality that appears to be one thing but isn't that. Which we'll come back to. So what I think he means here is the witness of the witness. The observer of the observer. The observer who observes the observer observing an object. Okay? In other parts of... So it's not an observer of anything particularly. It's the observer of everything. Not of any one thing, but of everything. So another image that comes into play in the text is like a mirror. The true self is like a mirror, and in the mirror appears both the subject and the object. Okay? It's the condition of possibility for subjects and objects to exist. Okay? It's the mirror. Or the container. You know, sometimes I think of it as the container that has no boundaries, of course, but in which everything is contained. It's like the empty space that makes possible the things in the empty space. So this room doesn't quite have four walls, but imagine it does have four walls. But where's the room that has four walls? You see, the four walls makes the room possible. You see? It's the emptiness that makes the room possible. It's the absence that makes the presence possible. It's the container that makes all things in the container possible. It's the snow globe that makes all the little snowflakes in there possible. And that's who he's talking about. Your true self is the globe. It's the mirror. It's the plenitude, which is also the absence. You know, It's the emptiness which is also the plenitude. You can say everything is empty or everything is full. It comes to the same thing. It's the same thing. It's the self. That is who you really are. So that's the Atman, really. If you don't identify with your physical body, deha means physical body, but instead say focused on your consciousness. And again, I think consciousness here means not consciousness of something, but the condition of possibility for consciousness. Okay? The arena in which consciousness occurs. Because consciousness is always consciousness of something, for it to be consciousness. So consciousness here is like a meta-consciousness or something like that. It's a step back. The condition of possibility for all thought, for all thinking. So stay focused on your consciousness. You will immediately become happy, sukha, at peace, shanta, and liberated from bondage, bandha mukta. If you do what? Completely re-identify yourself. Completely re-identify yourself. Beginning with de-identifying with the physical body. That is one of our most, maybe the most thing that we are most attached to, is our physicality. Isn't it? This is the fear of death. The fear of death is the fear that you will lose your body. And you will, of course. But the fear comes from thinking, I am the body. And therefore, I will be disappeared. And we all are very, very identified with the body. If you don't think so, we can like take you up to the roof and dangle you off the roof from your ankles and see, you know, how attached you are to your body. We all are attached to our body. But this text has many, many others. In fact, you could say it's the essence of a spiritual text to say you are not your body. That's what it means, spiritual, spirit. Okay? As opposed to the materialistic worldview, which says you are nothing but your body. You are nothing but you have no mind that isn't just the brain. See? But a spiritual text will always assume that you are more than just your body. That there is a ghost in the machine. And many of the neurobiologists still, like, you know, agree. Can't just reduce it. There's something more, you know, than just the physical brain to what we call the mind. If you don't identify with your physical body but stay focused on your consciousness, then you'll be happy. Then you'll be at peace. Then you'll be free. You do not belong to any of the castes. Again, another kind of like level of de-identification. You are not your social identity. You are not your social class. You know, the caste system, Varna, in India, as you all know, is very rigid and kind of complicated, actually, hierarchical and all like that. And he's saying you're not a member of any class. The real you, you see. Who is you? Who are you? And he's telling Janaka what he's not, you know. You're not a upper middle class, you know, white American, okay, or whatever. You're any particular stage of life, ashrama. There's four main ashramas in ancient India. The student, householder, what they call forest dweller, which was kind of an in-between state, and world renouncer. And he says, you're not your age group. You're not a young person. You're not a middle-aged person. There's no old people anymore. There's just middle-aged people. Do you know that? The older you get, the longer middle age extends. You are not your stage of life. You are imperceptible, unattached, and invisible. You are the observer of all objects. Again, he says, Sakshin again. The observer of all objects. The observer of the observer of all objects, I would say. So then he says, Suki Baba. Okay, this can also be the Sesame Street word of the retreat. Say Suki.
Suki.
Baba. Just be happy. Just be happy. Be a happy person. Sukhin means somebody who has sukha. Be a happy person. Relax already. You know? Already you should relax. You're not your body. Ha! That's good. You know, already starting to feel a little free. Virtue and vice. Pleasure and pain, these are all in the mind, and they are not you, my king. So virtue and vice, dharma, adharma. And then pleasure and pain, sukha and dukkha. And the reason he mentions these four is because many articulations of karma, you know, include these terms. And then he like follows it up. You are neither the producer nor the recipient of karma. You are truly and always free. So here he's pointing to the way out of the trap of karma, is to de-identify with karma. Okay, so what is karma? Well, you know, virtue and vice, pleasure and pain. This is the, you know, kind of like shorthand for the principle of karma. If you do virtue, you will get pleasure. If you do vice, you will get pain, unpleasure, displeasure, dukkha, suffering. So, what if you weren't you? See, what if you let go of the identity of the actor and acted in the way that we were talking about this afternoon, without expectation, without desire for what you're going to get out of the action? Action for its own sake. Action without attention to the fruit of action. Who would be the actor, you see? The actor depends on their being, the karmic actor, depends on an I that does something and then receives the benefit or deficit of that action. If you take the I out, there is no actor. And then he says, and you are not the actor. He says this more than once in this text. You are not the actor. You are acting like the actor. You're pretending to be the actor, but you are not the actor. Action is happening. You know, you can put it in the passive. Things arise, you know. Feelings arise. You know, action arises. Things arise. But you, identifying with them puts you into the karmic situation. Puts you into the realm of virtue and vice and pleasure and pain over and over and over again. So, again, just to be clear on this, there is no South Asian tradition that has ever said that the way to get to liberation is through karma. It is by escaping karma that you get to liberation. You can't karmicize your way into liberation. You can't work. You know, if you wanted to put it in Western terms, it's like faith and works. Faith and works, you know. It's all faith. It's all wisdom. It has nothing to do with works, you see. Works won't get you there. Karma won't get you there. It's wisdom about how things are working. You see? Not about working it. You can't work your way into heaven. You can't work your way into salvation. So be happy. You are neither the producer nor the recipient. You are truly and always free. So this is the beginning of where he tells him, look, you can be free anytime you want to be free because you've always been free. Bondage is an illusion. Bondage is false. It's just a false idea. You have always been free. The door has always been open to the self. But you're sitting in the cell thinking I'm prisoned instead of walking out of the cell. You are truly and always free. You have never been in bondage. The one who thinks I am the actor, here we go again, has been bitten by the big black snake of egoism. The word is ahamana. It's a very interesting Sanskrit word. Aham is the first person singular pronoun. I. And mana means pride. Pride in the I. Yeah. You've been bitten by the big black snake of egotism, thinking, I am the actor. I'm the one who's in control here. I will determine my fate. I will create better karma for myself. I will get enlightened in this very lifetime. In Nagarjuna, he says, there's one sort of verse where he says, a person who says, I will obtain nirvana, He says, that's a great grasping. That's a great grasping. I will attain nirvana. It is precisely when the I is dropped that you will obtain nirvana. So who's obtaining nirvana? It's dropping the I when it comes to action that gives us the possibility of escaping from karma. And there's lots of different ways that they teach how to do that. He's kind of going directly for the, you know, the wisdom end of it. Just realize that you are who you really are. You are not who you think you are. You are not, you say your name to yourself. You are not your body. You are not your thoughts. You are not your feelings. You are not your karma. You are much bigger than that. You are the cosmic one, in fact, he says. But other texts come at it differently. This is precisely, for those of you who have studied Buddhism, precisely what is meant by a bodhisattva. A bodhisattva is an actorless actor. Because a bodhisattva isn't acting for any individual, right? So we say in the, you know, standard phrase, for the sake of all sentient beings, right? But it really is acting as all sentient beings. And if you're acting as all sentient beings, then there is no actor at all, really. You know, you lose the actor in the plenitude rather than the emptiness. You lose the actor in the fact that everyone is an actor. I am acting for everyone. But there's no I involved anymore. You can't even say it. I am acting for everyone. It's no I involved. So there's lots of different ways to get to this. In the Bhagavad Gita, same teaching on karma yoga, how to act without being an actor, which means give up the idea of getting something from action. You see, if you're just acting for its own sake, like play, it is also selfless. There is no actor involved. Selfless action. So selfless in all its many senses. Selfless in the sense of compassionate action, of acting for somebody or something other than yourself, takes yourself out of the action. So then there's no actor. Or selfless in the more philosophical sense of who is the self anyway? You know, who do you think you are? You are not who you think you are. So he says, you're not the actor. If you think that you're the actor, then you are the actor. If you identify with the actor, then you are the actor and you will receive the consequences of action. And that's karma. And that's bondage. Okay? That's what keeps us in this suffering realm. Is that we want something, you know. The ego is constantly demanding and therefore acting. So when the ego is taken out of it, then the bondage ceases. Drinking the nectar of confidence, say, I am not the actor. No aham karta. I am not the actor. And be happy. And this is Suki Baba. So now you've shed your body. That's good. You're not identified with your body anymore. And you're not identified with the acting anymore. Ah, the big sigh of relief. Nirvana is coming. Nirvana means that. The big sigh of relief. Letting go of all this load. All this heavy burden that we're carrying around unnecessarily, thinking I am the body, I am the actor. Thinking I am the one pure consciousness. Burn down the forest of ignorance with the fire of conviction. Radical re-identification. Yeah, I am the one pure consciousness. Free from grief, say it, Suki Baba. Just be happy. This whole world of appearances seems to be as it is imagined. Like a rope mistaken for a snake. Very, very frequently used image in Indian texts. Like a rope that you mistake for a snake. Like if you see a curled up rope in a dim light lit room, you might say, oh my God, there's a snake there. But it's not a snake. It appears to be one thing and it is something else. That's what he's saying. The whole world of appearances appear to be as we imagine them. Kalpita. As we conceive of them. Many, many texts, I've just been translating one that goes through it many, many times, using the word nirvikalpa, without conceptualization, without thinking. See, this is another way of being free. We are imprisoned by our conceptualizations. We are imprisoned by our own minds. We're imprisoned by our ideas about things. And our ideas about things are not the way they are. Okay? I'll give you one just really gross example of this. Is this a changing thing or an unchanging thing? Is a glass of water is a changing thing? Everyone knows that, right? Everyone got the right answer. How often is it changing? It looks like it's staying the same for a long, long time here, doesn't it? Look, I can hold it. It must be something, you know. But how often is it changing? If we penetrate below the mere appearances of things and use our head, use our intelligence. Never mind wisdom. You don't even have to go to wisdom. Just go to intelligence. How often does change occur? Constantly. Nanosecond by nanosecond. Okay? This is in fact, it's changing so fast you can't measure the rate of change. Right? You can't even measure the rate of change. Does it look like that? The world of appearances are not the way they really are. The rope is not the snake. It looks like something that has legs. You know, has a little permanence to it, has some durability. It looks that way, but it isn't that way. Appearances deceive us. This is the beginning of wisdom. The beginning of wisdom is realizing that our senses deceive us, and then our minds get busy and deceive us even further. You know. We are imprisoned by our ideas, by our conceptions, by our names for things. So we have names for things like glass, glass of water, glass. And then we think our names refer to something. Right? To something. There's something that glass refers to. The word glass, the concept glass, refers to a thing out here in the world. But is it a thing? If it's changing at inconceivable rates, in what sense is it a thing changing? See, we say, it is changing. The glass is changing. Already our language has confused us. Because then we say, the glass, as if it were something that wasn't changing. And then the glass then changes. You see what I mean? There are no nouns. There are no nouns. There are no things. But there are ideas of things, that's for sure. There are imagined things. So to not mistake the rope for the snake, the whole world of appearances seems to be as it's imagined. So don't think that things are as they appear, including yourself. See, then he says, you are bliss. You are bliss, supreme bliss, ananda, paramananda. You are that pure awareness, sabodhatvam. Bodha means enlightened, is another word for enlightened. You know, here it means awareness, but pure awareness. You are pure awareness. So, Suki Baba, when you know who you really are, then you're going to be very sukha. You're going to be very happy. This one you can cut out and put on your refrigerator. Refrigerator magnet worthy. The one who thinks he is free is free. The one who thinks he is bound is bound. It is true what they say. Already they were saying this in the 9th century. You become what you think. See, it's all in the mind. You are what you think you are. Do you think you're bound? Then you are bound. You think that you're unfree, you are unfree. Because you think you're unfree. So how do you get free? Think you're free. Think freely. Think like a free person, like a free being. And this is pointing away to a very, very high practice, so I'll share this with you. You can try this over the retreat. Very, very good opportunity. Laboratory situation here. Laboratory conditions of just pretending that you're free. Just pretending that you're a Buddha. Just pretending that you're a god. You see, without any suffering, without any ignorance and so forth. This is called, sometimes called Deva Yoga. The yoga of being a god. The yoga of pretending that you're a god. And very high practice. Very high practice. Okay? Divine pride, they sometimes call it. Instead of being proud about your suffering schmuck self, take pride in who you really are, you know. And then imagine, what would that be? What would a divine being feel like? What would it feel like to be a divine being? Would a divine being be discontent, number one? Would a divine being whine and, you know, it's going to rain? And, you know, would a divine being complain about the food? See, would a divine being be anything other than satisfied all the time? Would a divine being think of themselves as we think of ourselves? As an individual? As a, you know, an ego? Or would they have a very radical, different understanding of who they really are? So put your head in that space. Try it. It's very difficult. It's because we're so attached to our little selves. We're so attached to our suffering selves. We're so attached to our unique snowflake self. See, I think that if you were really trying to do this right, that you wouldn't think of yourself as any somebody. You would have a cosmic understanding of identity. See, you would think of yourself as everything and everybody. So try it. Try to put your head in that space. Very high practice, actually. Very esoteric practice. The true self is the observer, all-pervading, complete in itself, one, free, aware, inactive. Inactive means not an actor. Doesn't mean they don't act, but not an actor, if you see what I mean. Action happens. Like poo-poo? Inactive, detached, without desire, and at peace. It is a mistake to think it's trapped in samsara. Samsara is an error. That's so good. That's so encouraging. Samsara is a mistake. And so if we correct the mistake, we will automatically be out of samsara. Samsara is a losing proposition. Kind of literally. Meditate on the true self. Immutable. Non-dualistic. Advaita. Now, advaita means not to. Advaita. Awareness. Non-dualistic awareness. Free yourself of the mistake of thinking you are the mere appearance of you, with a self-nature either outside or inside the body. So here he's like pointing to a very interesting kind of meditation that we're taught also in the Buddhist tradition of trying to find the self that we think exists either inside the body or outside the body, inside the parts or outside the parts. So we did, I think, a version of this afternoon. Just a quick review. Are you the same as your body and mind or different than your body and mind? So this is how the meditation starts, okay? And there's no third answer to that, is there? Are you identical with your mind? Mind and body means the parts of you, right? The parts of the self that we think we have. Are you the same as your parts or different than your parts? So there's only one. There's only two possible answers here. So if you are the same as your body, that's what he's saying, like within the body, inside the body. If you are the same as the body, how can you be the you that you think you are? How can you be, for example, a singular you? When you say your name to yourself, you're using the singular pronoun, aren't you? You're not saying, you know, a bunch of me's in there. We, unless you're like royalty or something, royal we. You say I, first person, singular, right? But if you are the same as your body and mind, how can you be singular? The body and mind is made up of many, many parts. How can you be unchanging? If you are the same as your body and mind, where is the unchanging part of either your physical nature or your mental nature? See? Oh, well, then I'll try the other one. Outside the body, independent of the body and mind complex. And that's impossible, too. Who would that be? Floating around like Casper the Friendly Ghost while your body and mind sits in your chair here. Separable from the body and mind. Who would be thinking that? Like I said this afternoon. If you were separable from your body and mind, who would be thinking, I am separable from my body and mind? See what I mean? You got it a lot better this afternoon. So you are with a self nature. It's a mistake thinking you are the mere appearance of you with a self nature, either outside or inside the body. My son, for a long time now, you have been bound by the snare of identifying with your body, with the sword of wisdom that says, I am pure awareness. Cut it through, and Tsukiba. You are already unattached, free from karma, self-illuminating and stainless. One must practice meditation. This indeed is your bondage. That's a really heavy thing, what he just did there. One must practice meditation. I have to improve myself. I have to get, you know, a better meditation practice so I can reach the fourth jhana, 4.7 jhana in the hierarchy of consciousness. You know, moving up the ladder, you know, like a corporate ladder, the meditative corporate ladder. Climbing it up, see, I must meditate. Oh, he's all over this, in this text. This is the first appearance of it. He says, I don't meditate. I do not meditate. I don't have to do nothing. I'm free. Yeah. No, it's radical. It's a radical text. Freedom is radical. You know. Imprisonment is conservative. Yeah. It's the way that we've always handled things. We, you know, like in an office, like you ever worked in an office where they say, like, you know, why did you put the rubber bands up there? No, well, we've always done it that way. You know, well, we've always done it this way. We've always thought that we could karma ourselves into enlightenment. I will meditate. I will learn to meditate. I will reach the fourth jhana. I will climb that corporate ladder. I will watch my morality. I will be a good person. And then, you know, and then what? And then you'll be imprisoned by morality. You'll be imprisoned by meditation. You'll be imprisoned. You can be imprisoned by your religious practice as well as anything else. So to be free means to be free of everything, including all compulsion, all compulsion to act. One must practice meditation. That's your bondage. Ayam hi te banda. It's saying stuff like that that keeps you in bondage. Truly, you pervade the universe, and the universe is contained in you. Your true nature, Swarupa, is pure awareness. Pure awareness means not being aware of anything, but the awareness in which all awarenesses can happen. You see what I mean? Pure awareness. Pure consciousness. So don't be so small-minded, he says. Don't think small. Identify with the big things. Don't identify with the little things, like your body or your feelings. We do this too, right? I am angry. I am sad. I am melancholy. Right? Identifying with little things, changing things. Transient things that come and go. Identify with the big things, he says. Identify with the cosmos itself. Your true nature is pure awareness. Identify with pure awareness. Not with awareness of something, but the condition of possibility for all awareness. You are unconditioned, unchanging, formless, serene. Your consciousness is unfathomable. And serene, I said again, I should have like changed that up. The word is aksuba. Aksuba means not agitated. So you know, you're chilled out. Abide only in consciousness. You should know that whatever takes form is unreal. Unartha. Does not exist as it appears. Whatever takes form does not exist as it appears. Shall we do it again? Does this thing look like a thing that's changing nanosecond by nanosecond? So this is form. This has form. All the objects of the senses are like this. They are all not what they seem to be. We project onto them our own ideas of them. We conceptualize. We have concepts, and then we project our concepts onto those things. And then mistake the thing for the concept of the thing. Yep. The idea of a glass of water, glass. We have a concept, we have a word for it. Then we project onto this constantly changing nanosecond by nanosecond process. You can't even call it an object. And then mistake it for what we called it, for what we think it. Okay. So all form is unreal. That which is without form is changeless. That which does not, near akara, that which does not have form is that which does not change. So, you know, in the Buddhist text they say that there is an emptiness to this object, which means, among other many, many other things, that there is something not there. What's not there in the object? Just unchangingness. Yeah. Unchangingness is not there. And the unchangingness of this object is unchanging. Okay? The absence of change of this object is unchanging. It doesn't get more or less unchanging. Okay? The absence of change doesn't get more or less. It is unchanging. So that's what he says, that which is without form is changeless. So that's the emptiness, you know, that's getting at it negatively. But you can also get at it positively. So that which is without form is also all form. All form is without form. Okay? If there's no right side, if there's no left side, if there's no top side, if there's no bottom side, then it's without form. It's full, but without form, you see? If it extends infinitely to the right, infinitely to the left, infinitely up, infinitely down, then it has no form either. It has no particular form, because it is all form, you see? So you can go at it either way. And then people have these big fights. No, things are empty. No, things are full. No, things are empty. There's an Atman. There's no un-Atman. See? Just finger fighting comes to the same thing. But it's expansion, that's for sure. It's expansion out of thinking that things are particular things. And that's the only identity that they have. You see? And including ourselves. That we are the ego. That we are the individual. And that's the only thing that we are. And so he says, think big here. Stop thinking small. Think about your changeless nature. And what would that be? Think about the part of you that has never been born and therefore will never die. And has never changed. And that's not you say your name to yourself. Because you were born. And because you were born, you will die. And if you think that that's all that you are, then you will be unhappy when you die. Because you will lose you. And you will, actually. You will lose you. But that's not the only you there is. This is what Ashtavaka is trying to get into Janaka's mind. That's not who you are. Tattvam na'asi. You are not that. You are not that little self. Identified with the body, identified with this life, identified with your feelings, with your thoughts, with your particularity. You are the universal. You are the cosmic. You are the cosmic consciousness. So identify with that. Just as form exists both within and outside the mirror that reflects it, so does the Supreme Lord exist both within and outside the body. So here's the mirror image. And this one comes up in many, many different teachings. For those of you who studied Dzogchen, they often use this mirror as the idea of your true nature. Your true nature is not what's reflected in the mirror. It's the mirror that reflects. Okay? It's the mirror that reflects everything. It's not the subject or the object. It's the mirror that reflects subjects and objects. The condition of possibility for subjects and objects. So, using the same kind of metaphor here. And using it with a little bit of a theistic kind of twist. You know, the Supreme Lord, the Parameshvara, who is nothing other than you. See, that's also, like, you know, implied. There is no God, there is no Buddha who is not you. And again, that's a teaching that we hear in a lot of different contexts. There's a wonderful, some of you know, there's a wonderful ritual in the esoteric tradition of Vajrayana Buddhism, where the initiator blindfolds the initiate and holds and then holds a mirror in front of their face and then says, take off the blindfold. And they take off the blindfold and immediately see the reflection of their own face. And then the ritual says, and there are no other Buddhas in the universe but this. You are looking at all the Buddhas in the universe. Yeah, nothing outside of you. Just as the one all-pervading space exists both inside and outside the pitcher. So if this were empty, and it were a pitcher, but it's a glass. Now, the empty space inside is the same as the empty space outside. Right? It's not different empty spaces. So just as the one all-pervading space exists both inside and outside the pitcher, so too does the eternal and pervasive, ultimate, Brahma in Sanskrit, exist in all beings. And it doesn't say exist more in some beings than anyone else. Okay? Everyone has what they call in the Buddhist tradition, Buddha nature. Everyone has this potential to realize who they really are. And everyone has it exactly equally. And he's saying the same kind of thing here. I think you can find some version of this in any authentic spiritual tradition. That everyone fundamentally, at bottom, is exactly the same. Exactly equal. That our true nature, at bottom, is the same. The particularities, the individualities, all that, like, you know, kind of makes us different, you know, makes us special, and so forth. But at bottom, we are all equally special. Or you could say equally not special. Comes to the same thing. All the same. So just as space inside the glass or outside the glass, inside the pitcher or outside the pitcher, the ultimate exists inside and outside. Inside of every being and outside of every being, and is non-differentiated. The ultimate, the who you really are. Brahma, he says here, which is often identified with Atman. Atman is Brahma. Atman, sometimes they say, is the self inside, and Brahman is the self outside. And they are the same. There's no difference, just like there's no difference between the empty space inside the pitcher and outside the pitcher. Well, you're looking a lot pretty glum for somebody who's just heard about their true nature. The exercise for class one is to meditate on the difference between the apparent individual egotistical self we identify and what our text declares to be the true self. And you can start this practice with de-identifying with the individual. And one way, one exercise they do that is to just watch what's going on in your life. Watch what's going on in your mind and in your body without identifying with it. And that's a good way to start, at least, in the process of this de-identification with the mind and body, with the particular mind, the individual mind, and the physical body. Just be a passive observer. Be a passive observer without identifying, without judging, without saying this is good, this is bad, and so forth. Just watch. Just watch it. That's a very very useful practice. And it's a useful practice because it conditions us to stop thinking of ourselves the way we do. See, we are who we think we are. And if you think you are your thoughts, you are your feelings, you are your body, you are your physical feelings one way or the other, then that is who you are. And you are limited. You are small. You are a snowflake, individual snowflake, but you're small and melting.